Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our Research Colloquium series talk. I'm really excited and happy that we have Dean with us today, who will be attending the talk. And so let's welcome our Dean first, and then welcome everyone in this room. Thank you very much for joining us. Today's talk will be on telecom policy by Michael McNally. Michael is our assistant professor and he's collaborating network investigator in the graphic animation and new media grant NCE project. His research is generally focused in the area of policy, telecommunication and radio spectrum. And by the way, he's our copyright guru. He has helped us to shape our copyright policy in the school. So let's welcome Michael McNally and let's hear from him about our emerging telecom policy that is related to, that might impact our digital divide issues in Canada. Am I right?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dinesh. And I'm really happy to be here and talking about some of the research I've been doing. Not so much looking specifically at the auction per se, but at some of the issues that are kind of percolating beneath the surface of the auction. For me, this research, I've been doing this for several years now, looking at spectrum. And I really want to thank Gregory Taylor, who's a postdoctoral researcher at Ryerson. And it was several years ago at a Canadian Communication Association conference where I went and he said, you know, the government is switching from analog over-the-air television to digital over-the-air television. This is going to free up spectrum, and we need more people to research this. And Gregory was spot on. We needed more people to research it, and we still need more people because this is an issue that for many of us had to always explaining what is radio spectrum management and the, you know, are your cell phone prices too high? Okay. Well, the government plays a part in that, not in the direct regulation of prices, but in the overall policies that boil down into the market conditions. But thankfully, over the last 6 months, this issue has become much more salient. So I have here... So this is out of Plains Magazine. And it was part of a series of campaigns run by Rogers, Bell, and Telus, Fair for Canada. And they were trying to spark people's rage at this boogeyman of Verizon coming to Canada. And this was really kind of quite a major news story in August, when we still didn't know whether Verizon would be coming to Canada or not. And they're not going to participate in this auction, but I do have an update on Verizon. But you know, they're very much trying to stoke national sentiment by, you know, this is equivalent of selling our precious natural water resources. So this was one side of things, and I've also got a Government of Canada ad that I'd like to look at as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about radio spectrum management in general, then look at the wireless market. I'd ask you if you thought your cell phone prices are too high, but you're going to say yes. The answer is yes, your cell phone prices are too high. And then I'm going to talk about the auction specifically, and then do not too much crystal ball gazing, but a little bit of where we're headed after 2014. So radio spectrum is a subset of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's invisible, it's intangible, it's flowing through your body right now. You can't see it, you can't hold it, yet it is an essential means for all forms of wireless communication. So everything from submarines communicating wirelessly at the deep sea to satellites in space, the radio spectrum is the key piece of... It's not even necessarily a technology, but the key piece of infrastructure that supports this. We have a very rich history of spectrum studies in Canada historically. Originally, this debate goes back to the 1920s when they were first having radio interference on naval ships, and this was really the push for government regulation. Dallas Smythe, who was one of the foremost Canadian communication scholars, was really at the forefront of discussions around spectrum management, both in the 1950s at the beginning of his career and at the 1980s towards the end of his career.
So we have a very rich tradition in scholarship. But if we've looked at what's happened over the last 6 months, there really aren't a lot of people studying this, and it's really a kind of black mark on the academic community that we've let this really important resource go understudied. And so if you read the newspapers, they're always talking to industry analysts because those are the people with the insights. Gregory Taylor, who I thanked at the beginning, he's made it into a few of the news stories. But by and large, we don't have the academic community in Canada that's really investigating spectrum policy. We do have some good research on the technical side. And that's another problem, too. The technical people and the policy people don't necessarily speak to each other. So I've got the URL here for this Government of Canada ad, and you may have seen it.
There's been a lot of talk about wireless competition in Canada. Fact is, our largest wireless companies hold over 85% of the airwaves. And Canadians pay some of the highest wireless rates in the developed world. Canadians want access to advanced wireless services wherever they are. It's time to talk about what's best for Canadians. More choice.
Lower prices. Better service.
Visit canada.ca/morechoices. A message from the Government of Canada.
So the Government of Canada is really wearing this policy. They're really staking out a claim that they want to, they're creating spectrum policy that's in the best interest of consumers. I do have to note that they disabled all the comments for the video too, though. So they're not that interested in what people actually have to say. So this ad has been airing more recently. We had the magazine ad from the Big Three. And of course, this is all boiling up towards the auction that'll really finally begin in January 14th, 2014. And we don't know when it's going to end. Industry Canada doesn't know. The actual auction process itself is incredibly complex. I've not met a single person who can explain it. I can't understand it. But it's this extremely intricate mathematical process. So what is the radio spectrum? It is a series of bands subdivided into various uses. And I know you can't actually read any of this, but this is what it looks like in Canada. So this is Industry Canada's radio spectrum allocations table. And the color coding is all different kinds of uses. So you have some that's allocated, some bands are allocated for satellites, others for radio, over-the-air television, and of course your wireless cell phone. And we're really interested in this section right here. That is the 700 megahertz section. So to zoom up, that's what it looks like. It's actually 108 megahertz total, going from 698 to 806. And where do we get this from? It comes from the decision to move over-the-air analog television signals to digital signals. So digital signals are much more spectrally efficient, and therefore, when we've switched, and it's now been mandatory since 2011, television broadcasts are in digital, so this frees up what used to be channels 52 to 69 in the radio spectrum. And we can use these for new purposes. And the purpose, of course, is going to be cell phones, wireless communication. This spectrum, in particular, is seen as highly valuable. It's often called the Cadillac or the beachfront of spectrum. It's old over-the-air television, so it's good stuff. It goes through buildings. It propagates quite a large distance. It's very useful for rural areas. And so this is really seen as the kind of key spectrum that everyone wants to get. And if you go back to 2011, 2012, and you look at what the telecom companies were saying, they said, this spectrum is essential to deploy next generation LTE services in Canada. Of course, Industry Canada has dragged their feet a little bit, and so the auction keeps getting delayed, and the telecom companies have rolled out their LTE fourth generation cell phone services anyway on existing spectrum. So the claim was a little disingenuous. But this is really high value stuff, and value is quite important to this proposition. So this little bit of history here, it goes back to about 2007 when the CRTC decided that they were going to push over-the-air broadcast to digital signals. That's now happened, and now we have this new spectrum that we can make available. And this is called the digital dividend. And we are behind the U.S. In terms of where this auction is going to take place. They had their digital dividend 700 megahertz auction in 2008. Interestingly, New Zealand just had their 700 megahertz auction. They have a very strange plan. They're going to auction the spectrum off and then let it sit fallow until 2020. So they have a very bizarre approach. But Canada's kind of middle of the pack. We're a little bit behind, significantly behind the Americans. But we're catching up. And this idea here, it's not reframing the spectrum. I didn't make a spelling mistake. It is refarming. So to go back to this chart, in many ways it's like a farm. It's like the old seigneurial farming system in Quebec. And you simply move things around. So we are going to move old over-the-air television to wireless cell phone spectrum. And in 2015, there will be a major international conference hosted by the International Telecommunications Union, and they're going to do global refarming. So because spectrum doesn't stop at the border, the ITU, which is an agency of the UN, coordinates things globally. And then within Canada, Industry Canada takes over from there. So in terms of spectrum auctions, these are a relatively new way to manage spectrum. I mentioned Dallas Smythe. If you go back to the 1950s, there was incredible debate between Smythe, who was very famous, Ronald Coase, who would go on to win a Nobel Prize in economics. He's one of the major founders of the law and economics movement, over to how to manage spectrum. And for years, what was done was what was known as the beauty contest. So you would put together your patch. I'm going to have a community radio station. I'm going to play lots of Canadian content. I'm going to give time to the local church and local schools. And Industry Canada would go, well, this looks like a very meritorious license, and I will award you a spectrum license. This was done for years, from the 1950s all the way through until the 1990s. And then you start to get this realization that there's perhaps a better way, at least from the government's perspective, to allocate spectrum, and that's the auction. Auctions, of course, very transparent. It doesn't have this mystique of the beauty contest where you're seeming to be picking favorites, so it's very transparent. The other interest here, and you can see from some of the numbers, is that it generates a lot of money. And it's been described as fiscal crack cocaine for governments. And I probably should insert a Rob Ford joke here somewhere, too. So the last auction in 2008 generated $4.25 billion. B with a billion. And this money just goes into general revenues. It does. There's no thoughtful use of this money. It's one-time injection because the auctions occur once and then there's a term for those licenses. So you don't get a renewing year after year fee, but it's okay. But this money is really quite astronomical in sums. And so the U.S., when they did their 700 megahertz auction in 2008, so they're many years ahead of us, they got $19 billion. The highest I've seen is for an auction in 2000 in Germany, where the German government got 50 billion euros. So this auction form of allocating spectrum is highly preferred by governments. And in terms of the 2008 one, it did produce new companies, Wind, Mobilicity, Public Mobile. Shaw bought a bunch of spectrum and never really did anything with it. And Videotron, which is a branch of Quebecor Media Incorporated in Quebec, and they've set up quite a large cellular service in Quebec and a little bit of Ontario. So we've had these new companies come in, and the government's claim that this has reduced prices is true. This most recent CRTC communications monitoring report kind of summarizes this quite effectively. They say, if you look at new entrants, so people like Public, Mobilicity, Wind, Videotron, Shaw, their prices are lower than Bell, Rogers, and Telus. And not only that, if you look at prices from 2011 to 2012, everyone's prices are going down. So these new entrants have created the competition that the government claims they're creating. Yes?
If you're the successful bidder and you get a section of the spectrum, can you then go and resell it?
There is extremely complicated rules around the licensing transfer. So these AWS auctions, that's what the Spectrum Band was called in 2008, Advanced Wireless Service, it came with all kinds of conditions. And in part of that was that you couldn't transfer the spectrum to a big three company for 5 years after the licenses kicked in. So Shaw is just sitting, waiting till 2014 so they can sell their spectrum to Rogers. As everyone knows this, there's no, they have an agreement in place that they're going to actually make a formal business transaction when 2014 rolls around. And this was, of course, in the summer, there was some talk around this too. Telus wanted to buy Mobilicity, and the government said, no, we are not going to let this spectrum be transferred. You know, we came up with the rules in the auction, and we're not going to violate those rules. And then as a footnote, no one really noticed when the government just let Public Mobile get swallowed up by Telus. And the government said, oh, well, the spectrum that Public Mobile owns is so low quality, it doesn't really matter. It's not like we're contributing to concentration. But that brings up a great point in terms of concentration. And I have several bar charts, for the most part, that look at the Canadian market. And so what you have here are these are four different existing cellular bands. So we have, and actually cellular is a bit of a misnomer, because cellular is a specific name of a set of bands. So there's the cellular band, the personal communication services band, the broadband radio services band down here, BRS, and the advanced wireless services. So the AWS was the most recent auction. Probably can't see maybe even the regions, but what stands out is the red company, Rogers, owns about half the spectrum in every market, in every band. And what makes up most of the other ownership is either blue for Bell or the kind of funny green, which is Telus. And then occasionally in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, you get little anomalies because they have SaskTel and MTS Allstream, so they have provincial players. But by and large, if you look at the cellular, the PCS, and the BRS bands, almost all of the spectrum is owned by the big three, with the exception of Manitoba and Saskatchewan, where you have a regional player. AWS one is where you see a little bit of change going on. You see some of these new companies come in. So the orange there is Shaw, the black is Videotron, Wind, Public Mobile, and Mobilicity. They are much smaller. Very similar shades of pink. It's not my graph, it's Industry Canada's. But we can see that the government has tried to at least address some of this problem in the last spectrum auction. So we now have more companies. Interestingly, though, many of those companies aren't very viable right now. In terms of Canadian mobile prices, a lot of discussion around price and how to compare price. And so one of the foci that's often looked at is average revenue per user. And this is where Canada stands in the average revenue per user, quite high amongst the top four countries. So for those who like to say our cell phone prices are too high, this is actually what they tend to point to, because it's a fairly common across-the-board metric where you don't have to compare different prices on different plans on different phones in different countries. So this chart is for many who are critical, an OECD comparison that says, yes, revenue per user is high, therefore that would suggest that the cell phone companies are making a lot of money off each individual. This kind of other element to correlate with that is the, you know, mobile phone penetration. And so Canada sits way down here, only above Mexico in the OECD. And if you look, China, Brazil, Russia, even Egypt are ahead of us. So we are very low in terms of the rate of mobile phone adoption. Part of that is because we have an excellent landline system. And there are still people who have absolutely no need for a mobile phone because their landline is very reliable. Yes? Off the top of my head, I don't know, but I could find it fairly quickly for you.
Because cheap landline and expensive mobile has held Canada back for a long, long time.
Yeah, we have the high quality, low cost landline is one area where we're we really kind of dense our mobile phone. Interestingly, though, this is mobile phone in general. If you look at smartphones, we're actually much closer to the global average. So they say about 37% in the developed world of people have a smartphone, or 39% of people in the developed world have a smartphone. Canada, we're 37%. So when you start looking at the newest, more high-end phones, we're very comparable. I do, thankfully, have some very current information on prices, though. And this is Peter Nowak, who's a journalist, not an academic, but doing some of the best research on Spectrum in Canada. And this is from October 31st, so he just did this. What he did is he went on the internet and he compared phone prices. And a lot of the times this is very difficult to do. In the OECD reports, they have all these extremely complicated baskets of plans and programs. And he was finally able to say, well, thanks to the two-year contract rules that the CRTC has put forward, we can finally start comparing Canada with other people. And so he took a look at the iPhone and the Samsung Galaxy S4 offered by Rogers and compared it in different Anglo-American countries. And you can see, looking at the total cost of the phone, so the monthly cost over 2 years, plus the upfront cost, and we're number two for the Galaxy S4, and we're number two for the iPhone 5S. And so when you kind of look at it at a whole, yeah, we are on the higher end of things. So the evidence would seem to suggest that, yeah, the government's claim is right. We do pay more for our phones than other people. And so this has really been kind of the core thrust of the government's arguments. And it's really interesting to see them want to wear this policy. So looking then at the auction, and this has been a really slow process. I was excited when the auction was going to happen in 2011, and then it got pushed to 2012, 2013, early 2013, middle of 2013, and now finally it is going to happen 2014. There's definitely been some slippage in the date. And which is interesting because the government will talk about how the rules are iron fast. We can't go changing the rules, but we can keep pushing the auction date back. To speak to this idea of a new cornerstone in Canadian telecommunications policy, typically these licenses are 10-year licenses. They're short. And that reflects that many different things. It's hard to value spectrum several years into the future because the technologies are constantly changing. Samsung, of course, who's a major innovator in the field, they've already said, we know which spectrum bands we're going to build fifth generation cell phones on. So here we are in Canada fretting about 4G technology with our upcoming auction, and other companies around the world are saying, we already know where the future is. And so it's interesting to see this lack of concern about the fact we already know what fifth generation technology will be like, yet we're so focused on the fourth generation stuff. But in terms of Cornerstone, these will be 20-year licenses, longest of any spectrum auction to date. And in fact, Bell has said in many a times, these licenses should just be perpetual. I mean, why can't we just get them forever? So they're obviously interested in owning this stuff for as long as possible. So this is really going to set up 20 years of Canadian telecommunications policy. And you see, think in terms of the wireless sector. Think back to 1994 or 1993. How many of us had a cell phone? Probably none of us. Maybe we knew someone with one. Maybe someone had a pager at the time. This was, in terms of the wireless era, like the Stone Age. So to think that we want to grant 20-year licenses is really cementing the results of this auction for a considerable time in the future. So I want to just kind of look. I should also mention the consultation. So this auction has had a significant degree of public consultation, and I've been doing some work with Lillian Pintos and Brandy Mowat here, where we've been looking at the consultations with an eye to see, are these consultations really democratic participation or a way of facilitating regulatory capture? And by and large, they're industry driven. The people who participate are industry. The people or the companies that Industry Canada cites in its policy documents are telecommunications companies. But it isn't really a captured regulator because the telecom companies disagree with each other so much. It kind of prevents the emergence of a captured regulator and a telecom cartel. But these consultations, very public but very poorly known about. So anyone can participate, but you really have to be kind of continually reading the Canada Gazette or the Industry Canada website to catch them. And I've talked with some of the people, Gregory Taylor and Catherine Middleton, who've participated in four of the consultations, and they say they don't feel like their opinion is given any weight. They might be cited in the consultation of the policy documents that come out, but they feel that it's just kind of name-dropping. And Brandy, Lillian, and I participated in a couple, well, in one consultation as well, and we felt the same thing. They mentioned our name in the policy document for the sake of mentioning our name. Is what it seemed like, and they didn't agree with us. So what does this auction look like? And there's been a lot of talk about blocks and prime spectrum. So if you take that 108 megahertz and you chop it up, this is what it looks like, and this is what's known as the band planned architecture. Very dull name. Effectively, what we've done is we've taken what the Americans did and copied them. And so a lot of interest in carving off some of this excellent beachfront spectrum for public safety. Of course, this goes back to 2001 and 9/11, and you had the firefighters going up the towers and the radios don't work. And so a clear recognition that public safety organizations need to have excellent spectrum that they don't need to get from commercial providers. So we've got blocks chunked off for public safety. We've also got these guard bands. Spectrum, of course, interference was the original drive for regulation. So you have to create kind of slivers in between the bands so that you don't have interference. And then you get down into these, just name them with letters, these named bands. So there are pairs of bands, A in the pink, B in the orange, and C in the light green. And then there's C1 and C2. I don't know why they have to have C1, C, and C2. And then D and E on the lower end of things, and then the D star on the upper side, which isn't going up for auction. So what this all works out to is there's about 68 megahertz of spectrum up for sale in seven different blocks, with four of those blocks, B, C, C1, and C2, which are paired, seen as the kind of prime spectrum. And this is where, if you go back to that newspaper ad, or McLean's ad from the Big Three, the real fear was that Verizon could come in and buy up two of the four prime blocks of spectrum. And of course, this is exactly what the government wants, is someone other than Bell, Rogers, or Telus to buy this spectrum. I should note that spectrum licenses aren't necessarily national in scale. In fact, they can be, Industry Canada has four options for license sizing. They're called tiers, and they're much like the blocks A, B, C, just numbered tiers 1, 2, 3, and 4. And in part of the consultation, the discussion was what tier size to use. They've opted for this tier 2 size. So it's 14 different regions, effectively all of the provinces, except for, I think, PEI gets lumped in with Nova Scotia. The territories are amalgamated into one. And then, of course, population-rich southern Ontario and Quebec are broken into a few extra regions. So we don't have one auction coming up. We have 14 auctions for seven different blocks. So it's actually 86 different auctions going on at once. And this is why it's so complex, because the way the auction is set up, it's designed to facilitate essentially 86 simultaneous auctions where you may have a lot of different strategic initiatives. So you may want to win a certain block in Saskatchewan, but if you don't win that block in Saskatchewan, then you don't want a similar block in Manitoba because now you're not going to be able to build your national network. So a lot of debate was made around tier sizes. People in rural and remote communities don't like large tier sizes because, effectively I could buy up the Alberta block, a couple hundred million dollars. But I'm really interested in serving Calgary and Edmonton. And it'll take a long time for me to really get out to the smaller communities. So Tier sizing is one element that's really important to kind of for promoting competition and rural deployment. And the concern over the rural population has been a really salient issue for the government. They want to, you know, this is not just wireless services for people in Toronto and Vancouver and other big cities. They want to make sure that rural Canadians benefit from this as well. And this is perhaps the biggest area of tension between the big three and the government, is the big three do have a strong claim to say, look, we're the companies who are going to roll out cell phone service in little towns because we have, you know, we have big national networks, and we want to make sure that, you know, you can pick up your cell phone and drive from Vancouver Island to Newfoundland and never lose your signal. So the big three really do have a kind of vested interest in claiming that they're the ones who are going to promote rural deployment. There are, of course, a number of different options. Industry Canada, as part of the conditions for the license, is going to require companies to roll out service. And this rollout, though, is based on population coverage, not on area. So within about 7 years of these licenses being awarded, so it would be about 2021, you have to cover 97% of the population that you currently have covered with existing technology. What that maps out to is kind of this. This is existing 3G cell phone coverage in Canada. You notice the north is chopped off because there is no coverage up there. In fact, once you get north, in most provinces, with the exception of Alberta, there is very spotty coverage. Now, there are all kinds of policy mechanisms that can be used to promote rural broadband and rural wireless broadband. There's even, as strange as it may seem, a use it or lose it type policy for certain bands of spectrum where a company can petition Industry Canada and say, you know, I tried to make a deal with Rogers and they won't sell me their spectrum for this tiny little community. So I'm going to appeal to Industry Canada to say, look, they haven't deployed spectrum in this area, and therefore you should transfer it to me. So this is a very obscure kind of little radio policy. There's all kinds of options for encouraging rural deployment. And I've got, if you're interested in the rural deployment side, rural broadband side, I do have a paper that is forthcoming eventually in the Journal of Rural and Community Development that I'd be happy to share. Yes?
Why is Alberta so good?
It's got to do partly with the provincial SuperNet, which is a huge backbone for wireless. And of course, you get into, you know, it's one thing to have the wireless connection to the cell phone tower. The cell phone tower then has to be connected to the internet somehow itself. And so because we have such a strong fiber backbone, it's been what has helped make our province, and that's of course the oil money, made our province the kind of real leader. So, and you can see, you know, Saskatchewan as well, with Sasktel having a provincially driven cellular provider, has done a fairly good job, at least in the southern half, of making sure everyone has coverage. Contra Ontario, where yes, you have blanket coverage in the southern tip, but really quite sparse once you get out to the more rural regions. So in terms of promoting competition, and this has been kind of one of the big issues, in the AWS auction in 2008, what the government did is we said, we're going to hold specific blocks aside, and we will only sell those to new companies. And this is why we got Public Mobile and Wind and Mobilicity. This time around, of course, the new entrants, those companies, Wind, Public Mobile, Videotron, they were in favor of this approach again. They said, yes, set aside spectrum specifically for us. The big three, no, an open and fair auction with no restrictions is the way to go. And the government very much picked the middle policy, which was, we'll put caps on how much spectrum one can own. And so these are, for lack of a better word, you know, spectrum aggregation limits. And these are very controversial. So what they've done is limit all bidders to a maximum of two of the paired blocks. So it's A, B, C, C1, and C2. And then for those prime blocks, they've said, Rogers, Bell, and Telus, you can only get one prime block. You can't have more than one paired prime block of spectrum. And what this effectively does is it ensures someone is going to be able to, if they're well capitalized enough, build a national network on prime spectrum. And the question of who is a great one. And I'll talk a little bit about the participants for the upcoming auction in the second section. Interestingly, SaskTel and MTS, they're considered like the big three in their home provinces. But the other thing is, if you sit here and you're doing the math in your head, it is possible to own 52.9% of the spectrum, or to have one of the big three companies still buy 52.9% of the spectrum, simply because there's those E blocks and the D blocks, which are unpaired and have no aggregation limits on them. So as much as this design for an auction is supposed to encourage competition, it's still possible, not likely, that one of Bell, Rogers, or Telus could walk away with a majority of the spectrum. So in terms of who's participating, initially there were 15 companies participating. We're now down to 12. And we see a number of telecom companies. So no surprise, Bell, Rogers, Telus, MTS, SaskTel, GlobalLive, or Wind. Of course, it was in a lot of controversy after the AWS auction because Telus argued that it was a foreign company. That's now been cleared up, partly due to the removal of some restrictions on foreign investment. Videotron, Bragg or Eastlink, which is a regional player in Atlantic Canada. Novus, which is a very, very small provider, and T-Baytel coming out of Thunder Bay. So a couple of large telecoms, a couple of new entrants. Notably missing, Public Mobile, it's done. Been swallowed up by Telus. Mobilicity has, it still wants to get bought by Telus. Failing that, it's going to auction itself off. And in many ways, I think there's been a lot of speculation that Mobilicity is just trying to get swallowed up by someone else, possibly Verizon. Shaw's not going to participate. They've not interested in not launching cell phone services. And of course, they're waiting until 2014 to sell their spectrum they already have to Rogers. Interestingly, though, Mobilicity's not involved, but there's these two little companies, Phoenix Wireless and Catalyst Capital Group, which are financially related. One's a primary debt holder, and the other is a company run by the current or former chief operating officer. They're in the auction. They've been registered. Industry Canada has okayed them. So there may be a play, essentially by a venture capital group, to buy spectrum with the idea of flipping it in the future. Verizon, the big boogeyman that was all the talk of the news in the summer, is not coming. No foreign company is going to come and play. And that's really, in some respects, where the government can be seen as failing. That being said, though, don't count Verizon out entirely. So what's going to happen? As I mentioned, this auction process is terribly complex. This combinatorial clock auction. Yes, Tony.
This is a really naive question, but is this like a physical gathering of people bidding, or is this all electronic bidding?
It's electronic. It's multi-day. A couple of people, there's a group of researchers at Ryerson, Greg Taylor and Catherine Middleton. They're trying to figure out how to monitor this in real time as much as possible. And this will be the first auction in which some kind of policy academics are really going to look at how does this thing really work on the ground. So this is multi-day, it's electronic. All the companies are forbidden from speaking to each other or even communicating more broadly their strategies in the media. So it's and that's why we've seen this campaign really take a quiet tone. That being said, Verizon is still in play. So on October 22nd, the Commissioner of Lobbying reported that Verizon had registered a new lobbyist in Ottawa to lobby the government on telecommunications policy. So It would seem like Verizon just decided to sit out the auction. And my best guess, which is what a lot of other people have said as well, is it looks like what they're going to do is watch and see what happens, particularly to wind, and how much spectrum wind buys, and then possibly try and make a play of assembling Mobilicity, wind, those Phoenix and Catalyst groups as well, if they get any spectrum, and trying to build a fourth national carrier that way. The other company to watch is Videotron, Quebecor Media. Of course, Quebecor Media is well-financed, it's a very rich company. They may want to make a play nationally. Wind, it's not as clear if they have the money. And in terms of money, Industry Canada has set out the minimum bids. So we know that the government's going to get at least $900 million, likely more. Could be in the $2 billion range, would be my guess. So the government, of course, is really hoping to ride this into 2015. And this is going to be, if they're successful in delivering more choices, lower prices, better service, an element of their election platform. It was in the speech from the throne. And of course, if you go to Industry Canada's website, they have a very fancy, this just plays the video that we watched at the beginning. They have all kinds of fact or fictions trying to counter the arguments made by the big three. And so in many ways, the government looks perhaps set to score a political victory if everything turns out for them. However, I like to think that people don't have too short of memories, and the government may end up with, for lack of a better word, some egg on its face. And so the government has really been trying to wear the policy, to say, we set up the policy, 2008 auction lowered prices, increased competition, we're going to do this again in 2014. But if you go back to 2007 and you look at the Spectrum Policy Framework for Canada, which is the primary policy document, it says, spectrum's a public resource, we all own it. The main goal of spectrum management is to maximize the economic and social benefits for all Canadians. Of course, there's no way of measuring social benefits of spectrum management. But interestingly, how do you operationalize that? Market forces should be relied upon to the maximum extent possible. And this was very clearly government-driven. It comes out of the 2006 very similar directive that Privy Council Office gave to the CRTC that said market forces to the maximum extent possible. Industry Canada followed suit in 2007. And this is, you don't need a degree in economics to realize that this makes for highly confused policy. The market is extremely regulated. There's all kinds of rules on tower sharing, roaming, customer hands-off, licensing transfers and frameworks. So it's a highly regulated market. It's also a very concentrated market. Often we use the term oligopoly. Really, if you go all the way back to the beginning and those bar charts, it's regional duopolies, which isn't any clearer. But it's not a market. It's not a market. And so on releasing competitive forces, we're trying to presume that market forces are going to drive down prices and increase competition when you don't have a market structure is really quite strangely flawed. And so it'll be quite interesting to see how this plays out. Who's going to make the big play? Who's going to be the spectrum winners and losers? And then does this have any political legs? I never thought when I started this years ago that spectrum would be news. I'd be able to point to an Industry Canada YouTube video about this, of all things, let alone the Bell Rogers TELUS ads. But this is where we are. And so in many ways, I'm kind of moving out of two research projects, one on consultations and one on rural deployment, and now looking with all eyes to see what happens starting in January, and who knows how long it will take. So thank you very much for engaging me.
Questions? Anyway.
If this is all corporate, will the government be able to filter any of the information in terms, there's certain media information that the government is able to filter. Will the government be able to filter that inner information that goes through the cell phones?
Not directly. Interestingly, though, there is an important point to bring up here. So the Canadian Wireless Telecommunications Association, which is the industry lobby that represents, now just represents the big three, because the little guys got out of it because they said, hey, our views aren't represented. They have said that the revenue from this auction should go to paying for lawful access legislation, which is legislation that will allow the government and telecommunications providers to more accurately scrutinize telecommunications signals. So there is a connection with the monitoring of the content, but not directly in terms of the government actively looking at what people are looking at on their cell phone.
We saw a huge advocacy and some activist efforts in Canada around digital copyright reform in the digital era. Is there some activity from our profession? This, you know, obviously copyright puts controls on access to information. With all of the digital LIS services which we promote in the field, I assume that we have a stake in having a position on this, and yet I don't seem to be aware of anything.
That is a great question, Tony, and I have struggled for quite some time with what is the LIS relationship to all of this. And it has dawned on me that if you look at broadband policy in the 90s, libraries were front and center. There's a librarian on the Information Highway Advisory Committee. As we've moved forward, though, with broadband policy, and Canada was a world leader in 2001, 2002, we've slipped, and we've also gone to increasingly now focus on connecting individuals rather than connecting communities. So if you look at, all the talk around wireless is about connecting individuals. And so in many ways, the library community no longer has a kind of stake right at the table. No one's saying we need to have wireless internet service provided by the library on a licensed band. The question I think for the LIS community is, do we say, okay, fine, it's not about connecting communities and libraries anymore, so we're going to have nothing to say about it, or do we say, this is still about access and information, it's about the infrastructure side of things, and we need to step up and contribute, in particular to the consultations where we can make a voice heard. So the Public Interest Advocacy Center has submitted to numerous consultations to try and give a public interest voice to what's largely a corporate process. And in terms of the LIS community, there's a few of us on the academic side who I'm aware of, and a few people in CLA as well who kind of keyed into this a couple of years ago. But I don't think we've seen the big momentum moving forward, and I think that's because in many ways the policy is cutting us out. It's not about communities anymore. It's about simply individuals.
Well, I think about the project Ali and Dinesh have visited 501 to talk about their collaboration with the Arctic North University project, and this seems to be inherent to that.
It wasn't on that map.
No.
Obviously.
Digital divide.
Yeah, this is a digital divide issue clearly comes through, particularly around the rural-urban divide. Cost is another big factor as well, and there's been a lot of studies out. Michael Geist was reporting one most recently that said, you look at the people who have cell phones and smartphones, they're people who are well off. The poorest people can't afford what are already high-priced devices and monthly plans.
I'm just wondering what analogous questions come out of this. It's a commonplace of the history of Newfoundland that radio revolutionized a very isolated society. But in fact, when radio came into Newfoundland, people had to be able to buy not only a radio, which was expensive, but also a reliable power source, because the power was erratic in these isolated communities, and so they had to buy a generator or some kind of battery arrangement. So it wasn't just a case of one day there wasn't radio and the next day there was. It was a very divided form of access. Apart from bandwidth, what are the other obstacles to universal access to this stuff? I mean, the price of the technology is clearly, and is there other stuff going on in there as well?
Well, one of the kind of big debates that they're having elsewhere in the world, in particular Australia, where they have a national broadband strategy, unlike Canada, is that, you know, wireless is very appealing technology, but it doesn't make sense everywhere. And so Australia has very clear 90% of their population will be connected with fiber optic, ultra high speed internet. And that's great for urban and even rural, most rural communities. And when you get to the remote populations, Australia's plan says spectrum works well, mobile wireless works well for 7% from so 90% are urban or rural. The next 7% of remote people can be covered by spectrum. And then, in fact, after that, it makes no sense because you start erecting cell phone towers for one people. So the final 3% will be connected by satellite-based technologies. So there's A, the question of what the technological mix is, and then there's a lot of infrastructure issues as well. Cell phone towers don't tend to be the prettiest things. And so the government has tried to put in place tower sharing requirements, but what the small companies often say is the big companies really foil our efforts. They drag their heels, they slow things down. So the tower infrastructure is a big thing. And the last one, I mean, is the technical expertise. I looked at the AWS auction. For some reason, there was a block of spectrum in Coburg that went quite cheaply. Cheap enough, I think it was $80,000. And that's cheap enough that a public entity could buy that, the city, the library, you name it. But the technical expertise that's required on these things is huge. And this is where, again, kind of the academic community is now playing catch-up, is Industry Canada and the big three telco companies have most of the knowledge of how this stuff really works, both on a policy and a technical side. And that knowledge just doesn't make it out to the population. And when it does, in terms of the government ad or the big three ad, it's so simplified and so reduced because it's the only way to make it digestible. So I think that's, in many ways, the biggest problem is just the complexity of it all.
So this is very clear that the government's controlling and careful and conservative approach still in 2015. Is taking this approach. Do you see any sort of major impact on the prices in the near future? Given that the players are really internal players, there's no foreign players like Verizon from the UK or other.
There should be downward pressure, would be my guess. In the same way that the AWS 2008 auction has resulted in some lower prices, we should see some lower prices. The flip side, though, is, you know, these companies are going to go out and spend hundreds of millions, potentially billions of dollars. They need to recoup that cost as well. So, there may be increased competition, there's, of course, paying for this auction, which is a big cost. In terms of prices, perhaps we'll see some downward pressure. The big issue, though, 2015, the World Radio Conference, where the ITU is going to do global refarming, a lot of people in particular saying, we need more spectrum that is unlicensed, spectrum that isn't sold effectively. So your remote control car, your garage door opener, your home cordless phone, and your Wi-Fi router all use unlicensed spectrum. And a lot of people are saying, if you want innovation, turn over more spectrum for unlicensed uses, and that's where we'll get real innovation and benefit, rather than this licensed side of things.
So you see this as more progressive than the spectrum back in 2007?
I don't know. I don't know if it's difficult to compare. In many ways, I mean, that the 2007-2008 auction was very good at bringing in new companies, but public is done, Mobilicity is on its deathbed, and Wind is likely hoping that the Verizon lobbyist is here to buy them. And it's interesting, the government notes they want to have four telephone wireless service providers for all Canadians. Well, the fact is, 53% of the population already have four service providers in their area. So it's an easy policy objective when you've already met it to claim it.
Thank you very much. Oh, sorry. I thought people are heading out, so we'll stop here. That will give them 5 minutes to go to the next class as well. Thank you, Michael, for a wonderful talk. Really appreciate that. And I know we have plans to think about one digital divide perspective, and we look forward for that. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming to the class.